Okay, so let's just jump in with the most important question. Of the three people who are in the running in this Democratic primary, why should the voters pick you and not the other two?
Well, we would change very much how city government feels to people in the city of Albany and change how it looks and change how people perceive it. What we have done here in this campaign is we've talked about issues that I think are very relevant here in 2017 here to the city of Albany, but from a accessibility and the point of view of the political process, we've really gone out and talked to people starting out on March 9th, we announced, and we were out at doors March 13th. We have met a tremendous number of voters, many thousands over that time period over the past 6 months. And I feel confident leading into September 12th that there will be those people that will reflect upon this process and they will feel that I would be a candidate that would listen to people, that would be very accessible. We've talked about opening City Hall on Saturday mornings again, which is a bit of a traditional feel to people, but we would really embody that feel that there's not this great distance between City Hall and the public that is represented, that we actually, in fact, would be far more representative. And there would be a number of people, too, many tens of thousands throughout the city that have been marginalized under the current administration that would now have a role in forming policy at the city level and getting to know their elected officials and top-level people in city government as well. So we feel confident on September 12th that hard work will pay off in the Democratic primary.
You've emphasized at various points in your campaign that, you know, you were born here, you were raised here. How important do you think it is that the mayor is somebody who grew up in Albany?
I don't think that personally that's something that, you know, I would hope that people would vote on the basis of policy. So they would look at something like, you know, our view on economic development, that we would not provide large tax breaks for developers of luxury housing. They would look at things like a red light camera program that has provided revenue only for an out-of-state vendor and not for the city of Albany. I would hope that they would look at those fiscal issues and more broadly, look at the city of Albany, a city that faces a $20 million deficit next year, a city that has had 26 shootings year to date this year, just as we are about two-thirds of the way through the year. And those would be things that I would hope people would vote on the basis of. The fact that I was born and raised in Albany one way or another, it's a descriptor that we have provided for people, but it's not something that I think should be influential in how people cast their vote. And quite honestly, I don't believe it will be either. So. You know, that being said, I mean, I'm proud of the fact that I love this city, and that's why I ran for the Albany Common Council, and I'm here for the long haul. I'm not here to run for a term or two terms and then cut out. I'm not looking for the next form of employment. This is something that would be a passion for me, and, it's a city I love and that I feel very strongly about going forward, that we could have a great future here and be a model for other cities in upstate New York.
I ask that because I think that there's a concern on the part of some people, and these are people, even people who are considering voting for you, that they worry that maybe that you are the new face on an old system of influence and power. And it's a return to a system where it matters who you know in terms of getting things done in the city of Albany. So for people who are concerned about that, what do you have to say to them?
Well, I think the description you gave actually really embodies the current administration, right? We're up against an incumbent that has considerable relationships with other elected officials, with developers of luxury housing, vendors and contractors for the city. Those are the relationships that this incumbent has built up. What we've actually done is gone out and met people at a grassroots level at their doors, and I think during the time period that I've been on the Albany Common Council, and clearly, we have a great level of support in the ward that I represent now, which should be indicative to folks that I would be an incredibly fair leader for the city, that I would work with as many folks as possible. And, the basis for that consideration, that folks would be concerned about that, I think is actually much more descriptive of the current administration. I don't see an administration right now under Mayor Sheehan that has reached out to as many people as they should have in city government and included as many people as they should have. And this was an administration that had a great level of political capital just 4 years ago when they were elected, had this overwhelming support as far as the percentage goes from the number of voters that had participated, although it was a very low turnout. But This was an administration that had the potential to do some great things, and unfortunately that opportunity had been squandered.
Where do you think that this current administration dropped the ball?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, it's a city that there is a considerable threat, and there's a threat to those public services that people rely upon here in the city of Albany. And that threat is a $20 million plus deficit next year. That was identified by a third party, not me. It was an independent third party.
Yeah, but you know, okay, so you've mentioned that number a lot. And that, I mean, that's number, it's in the PFM report.
Sure.
That's the name of the consultants, whatever that PFM. Right. And, you know, if you read through that report, you know, they project that that is a possibility. But there's a caveat in that, and that it's like, well, this is what we're projecting if nothing else changes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it details some of the things that can be done to be changed. And, you know, the Xi administration has already said, like, well, you know, we've already implemented some of these things. We're working on these things. And that number also doesn't take into account state aid. So do you think that number is still a fair one to use in terms of projecting for next year?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, it was created by a third party, an independent third party. And the Xi administration, if nothing else, has shown that they're unable to make those reforms and changes to city government that are needed. There has been an inability for them to, in any reasonable, intelligent way, increase revenue. They have been unable to grow the taxable economy in the city of Albany, and they've been unable to control expenses. In fact, just yesterday, as we're sitting here interviewing today on Wednesday, but just yesterday on Tuesday, we had a mid-year report issued that showed that overtime is far beyond budget in this year. That expenses are up millions of dollars over last year. These are things that, again, they've been unable to really manage city government. Now, even with an award of state aid, which is not a given, of course, it's not at all assured, but even with an award of state aid, it's, say, the same as last year for a one-shot again of $12.5 million, there is still a deficit then of somewhere between $8 and perhaps $11 million for next year, which could result in service cuts, new fees and fines, or layoffs of employees. So for the mayor to offer this presentation this year through her campaign that the city is in a good financial position, I think is very disingenuous, and I think a good leader would take head-on those challenges that a city faces. That's something that we've talked about throughout here, that there needs to be far more, far higher level of candor in our political process. And that we need to be willing to actually forthrightly discuss the challenges the city faces. Unfortunately, the other candidates in this race have been unable to do that to this point now as we are talking less than a week before the Democratic primary.
Okay, so that's a good question then. You know, in political campaigns, a lot of times it ends up sounding like everybody's going to get a pony and they're going to get ice cream with sprinkles on top and we're not going to have to pay anything extra. Mm. But of course, it never works out that way. So I'm curious about, from your perspective, what are some of the hard choices that the next mayor is going, or the next administration at least, is going to have to face that might involve the mayor having to make decisions that are unpopular but are necessary for the long-term health of the city?
Well, I think one of the first things we have to do is we have to be successful in engaging with leaders at the state level and achieving a multi-year stream of payments, similar to what the city had done in the year 2000, where there was a 30-year award provided of new aid for the city. And, of course, that is going to require a credible presentation to state leaders. I believe that, as mayor, I will achieve that multi-year stream of payments, similar to 2000, as I suggested. I believe the current administration is wholly incapable of doing that because they have run a campaign, a very expensive campaign, and a set of commercials throughout the city this year, just over the past several weeks and the past few months, suggesting that they've actually created a surplus in city government. So now they would have to go re-lobby folks at the Division of Budget, in the governor's office, in the Senate, and in the Assembly, although the Assembly has always been a traditional ally of the city of Albany, and that's a good thing. But still, there's other folks, the Senate and the governor's folks. You'd have to go lobby those folks and suggest again, well, that whole business of us having a surplus last year was just, you know, we were just campaigning. We actually really do have a big deficit. Well, that's going to create an inherent contradiction. And I think given that, plus the fact that the current administration has been unsuccessful over the 3.5 year period to date in achieving state aid, it would be a very challenging term coming up if the incumbent were reelected. Now, that is one item that we have to address. The other thing that I've been very forthright about with our employees, and many of our employees are supporting my campaign, and I'm very encouraged by their support, but I've talked candidly about the need to have an actual strategic attrition plan in city government. We will not be laying people off, but we will look at every opportunity when somebody retires or otherwise leaves city service to actually create savings. That's something that when we talked about that in this campaign and we were actually honest and really candidly spoke about that, there were some folks that suggested I was crazy. They said, how could you possibly say that in Albany, New York in a Democratic primary? But we did it, and I think folks, many people respect that, that have actually looked at this race, that have said, yes, that is a very much a reasonable alternative. That's a way that you can actually start to provide fair levels of compensation to other existing employees in city government, and it's a way to actually start to provide some relief for taxpayers by actually reducing the city's deficit. So we've talked about that as well. Those financial issues are huge. In addition to that, I think one of the biggest challenges we'll have going forward is how we reconcile from a public safety perspective. We have a city that's had a tremendous spike in crime this year. We've had 26 shootings year to date. And how we would reconcile the need to have more proactive policing, but also then recognizing a larger, more national sentiment about needing accountability in police departments. So we've talked about having more police in the neighborhoods throughout this campaign so that we could actually reduce violent crime and property crime. But we've also talked about new accountability measures, including a review of the CPRB and the powers of the CPRB, which is the Citizens Police Review Board, of course. We've talked about the need to designate tasers as a lethal use of force. And we've talked about, of course, having just a far higher level of accountability in our police department more broadly. And for all our police officers that are well-trained and well-experienced in their work, I do not think that would cause any problem whatsoever. So that is something as well that I think will be a challenge going forward, and certainly we need to make improvement on as well. At this point, we've provided a level of lip service to creating a community policing perspective, but there's no real evidence of that happening other than a few barbecues that we've had over the past several years.
I want to talk about policing a little bit more in a second, but I want to come back to this issue of these sort of hard choices that the next administration is going to have to make. You know, asking for more state aid, that's going to be a challenge, I think, probably to get that from the state, especially on a multi-year basis, but I think everybody's generally in favor of that. I think an attrition plan, I think most people, that makes sense to them. They're going to be generally in favor of that. To me, you know, one of the central questions in all this is that for the long-term financial health of the city, at some point, a mayor is going to have to do things that people do not like. Then they're going to have to cut the number of police, as the PFM report recommends. They're going to have to hold the line on raises for the city's labor unions. They're going to have to make some sort of drastic cut to services that people aren't going to like. They're going to have to raise trash fees, something of that nature. And I think when you talk to people privately, this comes up. You know, people acknowledge this as a reality that, you know, the city has kicked the can down the road for too many years across multiple administrations. So, you know, when you look to the future, I guess, what are some of those points where you're going to be willing to stand up and say, you know what, I realize this isn't going to be popular, but I'm going to do this anyway?
Well, I do think an attrition plan qualifies for that. Neither of my opponents have talked about that. I'm the only candidate in the race that has talked about having an attrition plan going forward. But in addition to that, when I became a council member, about 46% of the city was taxable. Now it's about 37% taxable. So how do you start to address that as well? Well, from an economic development perspective, you start to invest in your own people. And one of the challenges we've had with this administration has been just this incredible emphasis on luxury housing and providing tax abatements for developers of luxury housing. We've actually talked about investing in our own people, where we have these vacant abandoned buildings throughout our city, over 1,000 by the administration's own count, and having that investment go in where we can actually start to create more taxable property with a modest incentive. Additionally, I do think that the issue of achieving state aid, it is one of the big challenges, because while people agree on it, the current administration has not been successful in achieving it.
They just got $12.5 million from the state.
That was a one-shot that is not at all guaranteed for next year whatsoever. In fact, not only is it not guaranteed, I actually think with the current administration, it's unlikely that there would be a multi-year award. So they've received two one-shots in 4 years. We've talked about creating a multi-year stream payments. And again, I don't think that this mayor has been good whatsoever at developing relationships where she could achieve that. We shouldn't be here talking after 4 years and very much public asks for state aid and still be unsuccessful in that regard. The other thing we've talked about is, in addition to changing the way we pursue economic development, but I do believe, and many others believe, that there is some systemic abuse of the charitable exemption in the city of Albany, and we've talked about reviewing all tax exemptions in the city of Albany, all $8.6 billion next year. And that's something as well that requires a level of courage and independence. You need to be able to stand up to folks that might be associated with the most wealthy, influential entities in Albany, like an Albany Medical Center, a SUNY Poly. Again, the current mayor has not demonstrated any capacity to stand up to them. In fact, the policies of the Sheehan administration have actually benefited the large tax-exempt institutions. I would argue, and I think many others argue, that the policies of the city have been far more favorable to people that don't pay taxes than people that do. And these are wealthy people that don't pay taxes, wealthy people that many of them don't live in Albany. I could cite the sale of the Palace Theater. I could cite the garage at Albany Medical Center. I could cite new for-profit private dormitories on Washington Avenue. Of course, in the unfortunate occurrence that the incumbent were ever reelected, of course, you'll have a large tax abatement on a new development on Laughlin Street, which was formerly just single-family homes up on a small street in Albany, and you'll have tax-exempt development there. Yeah, so we really have a corporatist, though, that is taking over city government and is now providing large tax breaks that is being funded by rank-and-file taxpayers while espousing and providing the rhetoric of allegedly providing an equity agenda to folks in Albany.
I think this issue of tax breaks is important. Mm-hmm. It fully deserves attention and scrutiny. I think it's also nuanced, and I want to make sure that we don't lose that nuance. So when you talk about these tax breaks, like you mentioned Park South, the big mm-hmm. redevelopment there in Park South, I think, and this is how I recall it, and I want to make sure, mm-hmm. if I'm incorrect about this, please tell me. You have referred to that as being not taxable, and I think that you've said that because they're not paying taxes under the typical property tax system, but there is instead a pilot set up for that, a payment in lieu of taxes arrangement. Mm-hmm. Is that why you refer to that as non-taxable?
Yes, and to expand on the pilot. The pilot, the payment in lieu of taxes, is minuscule compared to what they would actually pay if they were a taxable property.
Well, but when it went through the IDA, sure. I mean, the pilot's worth, I think, about $11 million. And as the IDA, I think, concluded, that was about $6.5 million more than that property would have paid otherwise.
Well, a few things on that. One is, the IDA numbers, and the IDA has developed a horrible practice now of actually reducing assessments of properties. They are now in the business of grossly reducing assessments of properties. So when they say what the value of a pilot is, they always, again, undercount what those really would be. Great example is at 1475 Washington Avenue, where, of course, a building that just took out a $28 million mortgage a few years ago has a $12 million assessment. So a big part of their tax break, in fact, over 50% of their tax break, is in the form of something that is a horrible practice, which is undercounting what the assessment should be. Additionally, the analysis of that they're paying more than what was otherwise paid, that's a classic neoliberal model, that is a neoliberal analysis that is done at the local level by mayors to never take into account what the cost of the services provided is. So when you have these new entities come in and they have a tremendous amount of traffic that is drawn into the city and people that are drawn into the city, it is very much the tact of folks that want to promote these projects that they will consistently not account for the cost of services provided. So that, again, is something that the current administration has done and very willfully done, and they know that it's a ridiculous analysis. And I think most people that understand economic development know that that's been one of the pitfalls in New York State, is that there never is a true accounting for the cost of the services provided to those entities once they expand into multi-level, more densely populated, or more draw more traffic and parking needs into that area. So I disagree with that analysis, that there is some greater payment than otherwise would be paid, because I don't think it's the valid analysis that really should be provided.
So I guess going forward, when projects like this come up, would you rather there not be a pilot? Or are you just saying that the city, I guess technically the IDA, needs to drive a harder bargain?
Well, a couple things. One is Albany stands out amongst IDAs in New York State for providing the most incentive by far to developers of luxury housing. Our IDA should actually start getting in the business of actually trying to incentivize commerce to come in the city so that people can have jobs, not just during a capital phase, but also during a operational phase in perpetuity thereafter. And in addition, we would change how we allocate those resources of tax incentives. I think they should be going to Albany residents who want to rehabilitate and increase the value of vacant and abandoned buildings. And we could start to improve our housing stock. Now, we would have to supplement such a program, or actually I should say complement such a program, with other sources of funding as well to get people into the South End, Arbor Hill, West Hill, North Albany, to really start getting these red X placards off these buildings and actually start to grow them. But what we're talking about is building an economy from the bottom up. Effectively, what has been practiced by the current administration is a form of trickle-down economics on the local level. And we can actually build this from the bottom up and invest in our own people, create local income, local wealth, and I believe also improve our stock of quality, affordable housing throughout the city.
Let's go back to policing because this is an important topic. And you have been critical of the current administration's, at least their talk about community policing. So I'm curious about, I guess, something that's a little bit more philosophical. Like, for you, what is your own idea or theory about the roots of crime? What causes it? What prompts it? What causes it to propagate?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, I look at economic issues. And when you have a city where there is not opportunity provided to a large number of people, many thousands of people are left out of any economic progress in your city, I think you'll have an outcome where crime is more prevalent. You'll have more property crimes. In some cases, you'll have more violent crime. You need to provide people with good housing. You need to provide people with good infrastructure, good city services. Then you'll attract more people in. You'll have better economic outcomes. Folks that are involved in the progress of the economy, I think, are far less likely to violate others' rights, either through property crime and or violent crime. That's to answer your question from a theoretical perspective. I think you need a strong economy before anything else. Then in addition to that, I think part of the solution as well, and I'm probably going further than your original question on this, but you do need strong programming in place for young men and women so that you can, not every instance of crime then becomes a policing and a matter for the courts. There's ways to actually divert young men and women beforehand. So if you have some strong programming in place in July and August for children in Albany, things that I was able to take advantage of many years ago back in the 1990s. But if you have that programming in place, not just sports when I say recreation programming, but beyond that, I think there's a 21st century model, you're in a great position. Unfortunately, the city adopted a charge model, which netted the city only $8,000 last year because all the kids dropped out of the programs. And $8,000, of course, to an $170 million organization is, it's nothing. It's a drop in the ocean. So we should have that strong programming in place. And I think from a gang prevention, truancy abatement model, there's other programs as well that we could build up and start to divert people from getting involved in crime. But most importantly is, this is very much, I believe, to your first question about the theoretical basis and foundation of crime and what causes crime, it goes back to the question we were just talking about, that if you have an economy that favors more people and gets more people involved in the success of the city, then you'll have far less crime. And unfortunately, I mean, I talked to you as I say this. Yesterday, my wife and I had to file a police report because we had property crime at our house. And I live in allegedly one of the, for your listeners, insert the quotes here, but one of the nice wards in the city, right? And you know, I hate to be so candid, but that's what we've been doing throughout this campaign is just speaking about the facts here in the city. I live in one of the nice wards in the city, allegedly, and you know, we had our cars broken into the other night. I mean, this is going on throughout the city. There's property crimes throughout the city. And, of course, we've talked about the violent crime you've had with 26 shootings year to date as we sit here talking on September 6th. This is not the right direction the city has taken. And to gloss over that and suggest to people that crime is down is another piece of misinformation that has been well-funded and well-financed by the incumbents' campaign, but it's just not a real accounting of what's going on in the city.
So let's just be straight about that. So when they report the crime stats, you're saying that they are fudging the crime stats?
What I'm suggesting is that crime is dramatically increased in the city of Albany. It's very apparent to anyone here in the city. I mean, statistics can always be manipulated one way or another, and they haven't really reported a whole host of statistics. They just seem to suggest that we're on the right track as it relates to policing in the city of Albany. Well, you can't be on the right track when you have 26 shootings in September. You can't be on the right track when you have a rash of car break-ins in a given neighborhood over the course of 3 weeks like we've had in our neighborhood, including our own. You cannot be on the right track then with policing. It's very self-evident to people, regardless of the statistics you provide. The perceptions about crime are what is driving decisions amongst people. And if you want people to stay in Albany and you want to attract new people into Albany, you need to be perceived to have low crime. It needs to be perceived to be a safe community.
I think a lot of people perked up, I think it was during the Times Union debate, when you brought up the issue of 787 and turning into a boulevard. That is, in my experience talking to people, that is something that is very, very popular within the city of Albany. It is also, from people I have talked to who are in the know, people who are planners and transportation people, they also acknowledge that it will be tremendously difficult because it will be hugely expensive, and logistically it will be very difficult, politically it will be very difficult. And it's an issue that is largely out of the hands of the city, that it's more something that will happen on the state and regional level. So for the mayor of Albany, if this is a goal, to see 787, the elevated portion, taken down and turned into a boulevard, you know, it seems like it's going to be more a matter of focusing attention and generating support and building a campaign for that. So as mayor, is that something that you're willing to do? And if so, I guess, how do you go about building that campaign?
Well, I would say this. The city has had successes in the past with the state, right? We hit a period of time in 2000 and 2006 where we had some folks at the state level. At that time, you had Senator Bruno, was very influential, and he was from the Capital Region, of course. And we were able to achieve things here for this region that were significant. We need to, again, try to develop those relationships where Albany, as a capital city, is able to have those relationships with state leaders. Now, 787 itself is blocking the city from its most valuable land that could effectively be taxable if we could find a path and a way to get to that land. Additionally, and just as importantly, if we had a major infrastructure project on Albany's riverfront, we could start to deal with our tremendous stormwater management challenges that we have, which are very costly. And if we could build retention into any plan where stormwater during a heavy rainfall event could be in a retention, some sort of holding of a retention basin, then we could actually start to manage our stormwater where we don't have these 4 million gallon overflows into the Hudson River and we simply dismiss them through the governmental legal jargon of, well, it's a permitted overflow. It's a permitted overflow. It's still not a good public policy outcome, and it's something that from an environmental standpoint has some significant environmental degradation. From an economic standpoint is really hurting what could be an asset. We have a friend here who just developed last year, without any incentives or tax breaks whatsoever, a private marina on the Hudson River. That is not good for business and the development of our riverfront if we have these overflows. So I think 787 could be part of a comprehensive project. Your premise is correct that it is not a city project. It is something that would be regional and really require state funding as well, and perhaps federal funding in addition. So there is some significant relationships that need to be developed. But again, to date, if I look at the city of Albany over the past 3.5 years, objectively, I think there's no reason to hesitate from saying that those relationships aren't in place for the city of Albany right now. We are unable to achieve our legislative asks of state leaders, so we need to do much better in that regard and develop those relationships, and I think we can do that very promptly starting next year.
If you don't win on Tuesday, what would you hope that the winner keeps in mind over the next 4 years?
Well, we've run a campaign that has geared us up towards a victory on September 12th, and I think something we will look at right away. I mean, we have a first 90 days, quarter of the year, if you will, agenda in place, and we're going to find ways to build up the city's economy, and that means that we have to look at our IDA. we have to look at the audit of tax exemptions in the city of Albany. This has to be a city where middle class, working class families can thrive, where young people can come into the city of Albany, and many will rent, but perhaps some can buy a home because the escrow will not be so daunting over the course of a 30-year mortgage or even a 15-year mortgage product. I mean, that needs to be where this city is, that people can come here and there is a level of financial confidence in the city that this economy is growing, expenses are controlled, the base of people paying in to the city is expanding. That is how you will attract people long term. And I think there are many inequities in the city, and the city pays lip service to many of them, but one that doesn't even have lip service paid to it, much less not even having the policy options put in place, is related to economic inequities. And we need a level of economic justice in the city as well. I don't think that economic justice is confined to any one area of the city. I can name neighborhoods across the city where there are people that are left out of any successes that take place in the city of Albany. And as mayor, that's something we would greatly look forward to doing.
As people head into the booth on Tuesday, what is the one message from you or that one soundbite from you that you want playing in their minds as they make their choice?
Well, we've talked about a city that has a $20 million deficit, has 26 shootings year to date this year, and those are things that are unfortunate. Those are things that we look at and we don't like here in the city of Albany, but those are the facts. And we've run a campaign based on the facts. They can have a far higher level of political candor, political honesty in a commissal administration. I think as well you can have far better financial outcomes for the city where we actually have a sustainable, growing city as well. But ultimately, I want people to look at that honesty and candor that we've provided throughout and address which candidate they think is more positioned to address the challenges of the city of Albany. And if you can't recognize the challenges, and I don't think my opponents have been able to adequately address the challenges in the city of Albany or recognize them, then how could you ever possibly start to resolve those issues? So a vote for one of my opponents is a vote for, at best, mediocrity for the next 4 years. There will be no major successes of city government. What we can do with an administration, if I'm so fortunate to receive the most votes on September 12th, is go really start building up city, building up more neighborhoods, building up more people. We can get away from this corporatist policies of these neoliberal policies of the Sheehan administration. We can discard those promptly and move forward with some real policies that help working class people. If you think of it, and this is a partisan matter, so I don't mind talking about the politics of the Democratic Party. I've said that throughout this campaign, is look at Democrats that used to have a great advantage on economic issues with working class people. Very true. In the 1990s, when I was growing up, of course, Bill Clinton experienced significant advantage in that regard. Of course, President Obama had an 8-year term in that regard as well. Even the two races that were national when Bush had won in 2000 and 2004, there was still many people that on economic issues voted with the Democrats. They held traditional states. And now suddenly this past year, we have a president now won over voters that traditionally had voted Democratic for years in states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, Ohio. So how do you start to build up your Democratic Party again? And well, you do it through economic issues. That's what matters. Even when we talked before about crime here in the city of Albany, there's economic issues that underpin everything. And if people don't have the appropriate housing, if they can't provide for themselves and their families, if they can't live a good, healthy life where they have good employment, that is a major problem that will lead to other societal ills. We want to address those here. We recognize those. We speak candidly about those. For folks voting on September 12th, and I hope many do, I hope that when they go in that booth, they go and they say, we can do so much better than what has been provided over the past 3.5 years.